new rules for the Hudson River VFR corridor. Good idea or not? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into the Aero News special feature. Thanks for downloading us today. My guest is Bob Miller, flight instructor based in the Buffalo area, also the publisher of Over the Airwaves, the journal for the proficient pilot. Our regular listeners are used to hearing Bob on Monday as we chew through safety topics that don't get covered properly in the regular media, I guess. Bob, thanks for joining us today.
As always, Paul, it's always a joy to be with you and share our thoughts with your listeners.
Well, we talked about the midair over the Hudson River between the helicopter, tour helicopter, and the Piper a few weeks ago, and now there are special flight rules proposed for the Hudson River VFR corridor. And I can't really tell from your headline in the September edition of Over the Airwaves whether you're a fan of that or not. So tell me what you're thinking.
Well, I just said that we're having new rules, duh. You know, as if it came as any surprise that the rules would be following. This has been fairly typical of a high-profile accident like this, that the rules would be recommended and followed. I think it's just because of the public outcry that the FAA do something other than just simply accept the fact that this occurred, even though it was an extremely rare occurrence to begin with. But the proposed rules that have come out are, you know, in reviewing them, they make sense. They're logical. They set as a floor of the Class Bravo airspace at 1,300 feet, MSL and AGL, by the way, which is all the same out there because we're dealing with sea level, a consistent level of 1,300 feet. When if you look at a terminal area chart for the New York City area right now, you'll see that the floor of that Class Bravo space varies all over the place from 1,100 feet up to 1,500 feet and then back down. So you never really knew whether or not you were in or outside that Class B space. So what they've done or what they're proposing to do is to set a uniform floor of the Class Bravo space to 1,300 feet. And then you have choices. You can fly the corridor under the proposed rule at or above 1,300 feet VFR, between 1,300 and 2,000 feet VFR, but you have then the same Class B rules that we always had. You have to establish a clearance to get in there. Of course, you have to maintain two-way communication, and you're under positive ATC control, even though you're flying under VFR rules. Now, you can also elect to fly beneath the Class B airspace, and what they're proposing is an area of between 1,000 feet and 1,300 feet, which would be below the Class Bravo airspace, but they've set up some additional hard requirements. It used to be recommended that we turn our lights on. It was recommended that we have air-to-air frequency communications going on. Now these are proposed to be requirements, so that to operate below the Class Bravo airspace, you would be required to maintain air-to-air radio communication with all other aircraft, turn on all of your navigation lights, anti-collision lights, landing lights, and operate a speed not to exceed 140 knots. And then also pilots would be required to announce when they enter the area and to report the aircraft description, location, direction, and altitude. And also it would be required that northbound flights along the river fly along the eastern shore of the Hudson River, and southbound flights be required to fly along the western shore of the river. So it's codifying, if you will, what perhaps as my experience has been pretty much standard practice among those of us operating in that airspace. My preference has always been to receive flight following, and in much of the time I was operating in the Class Bravo airspace. But never to be outside of ATC communications along that entire route.
Well, Bob, let me make a few comments on this and get your thoughts, because to some extent this makes sense to me. Does allowing VFR between 1,300 and 2,000 feet, does that allow for perhaps down the road having different altitudes assigned for helicopters and aircraft, as happens over Niagara Falls in your area?
Well, yeah, it works over our area and it works over other areas, because we enter and exit the Niagara Falls Scenic Falls area from some distance. We may be entering 5, 10 miles from any direction. So we're actually entering that airspace at a consistent altitude. The problem with the New York City area, we have people on the ground right underneath it, helicopters specifically, that are lifting off and climbing up into it. So that I'm not sure altitude assignments, you know, keeping the fixed wing above and helicopters below, that might work. It would be interesting to have a conversation with the folks that actually have been involved in the redesign of this airspace to see their comments as to whether or not that option would have solved the problem. But the suggestion that they have right here is the recommended procedures makes sense. And it really does make sense. It's just putting in print again what the understanding was of pilots operating in that area. We always either maintain communications with ATC or via air-to-air frequencies with other aircraft, and we all certainly had our lights on, and we were all moving up the river on the right side, just like an automobile, and down the on a highway and southbound on the other side of the river. So traffic was passing us on the left in the opposite direction. All of these things made sense. So when I read the proposed regulatory changes, this is not a great deal different than what we've always had. There will also be a requirement, I understand, for pilots to take an online course on the Hudson River corridor requirements, much the same way as we're required to take a course to operate VFR in the special flight rules area of Washington, D.C. That is a requirement, and I suppose that would be an enhancement to what we already have, and it would put everybody pretty much on the same sheet of music before going into that area.
All right. Well, I have a couple more questions I want to ask you after the break. My guest is Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, back with more in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
This is a story of two pilots. Our first guy, the one with Garmin Waas GPS, he just arrived home from a trip, ready to enjoy a nice home-cooked meal with his supermodel girlfriend.
Chérie, viens près de moi.
But our other guy, the pilot without Waas, well, he couldn't quite make it home. Had to divert to an airport with an ILS approach. So now it's dinner from a vending machine in some crummy pilot's lounge. You know which pilot you want to be. Garmin Waas GPS. Follow the leader.
Chérie.
At Cirrus Design, we don't ignore the fundamentals of aviation design. We just give them an ingenious new interpretation. The Cirrus SR20 G2. Interested in a substantial airplane that remains practical and affordable? Whether you're a non-pilot looking to begin flying lessons, a pilot needing personal transportation, or a fleet customer selecting the best plane to meet the demands of a multiple aircraft operation, consider the SR20 G2. To learn more, call 888-750-9927 or check us out on the web at cirrusdesign.com.
Welcome back to the Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Miller of Over the Airwaves, discussing special flight rules proposed for the Hudson River VFR corridor. And Bob, you've done a good job of running down what these rules are going to be, but I have a few what-ifs, because if nothing else, my work with Aero News and the study I did before I decided to take even ground school regarding accidents and what actually causes accidents leaves me with some questions and some observations about what goes wrong when we get in an environment this regulated. First of all, if we're required to take an internet course to fly in this airspace, the tower is not going to know if we've taken it or not. I wonder how many years it'll take, or whether it's ever even conceivably possible that every pilot flying in that space would have taken that course.
Well, sure. I mean, that's so true with all of our recurrent training requirements. I mean, ATC doesn't know if we've had our 3 takeoff and landings in the last 90 days when carrying passengers. I mean, there's a lot that they don't know, and there's certainly a good deal of the regulatory requirements on us pilots that nobody really knows whether or not the course was taken, I suppose, until after the accident. And then the pilot is asked to produce some sort of proof that he took the course, and that proof is evident. I mean, we receive a certificate when we satisfactorily complete the course. But where I thought you were going with this is a statement I had quoting Randy Babbitt, the FAA administrator, in the current issue of Over the Airwaves, or the August issue, I should say, that He said, and I'm just paraphrasing, that there's no amount of regulatory requirements that can be imposed upon a pilot if the pilot isn't, you know, flying heads up. And certainly in the Hudson River corridor or any congested airspace, the pilot has a responsibility to see and avoid, to look out the window. And the jury's not in yet on the helicopter fixed-wing crash that took place as to actually what the probable cause was officially determined to be. But there's some evidence to suggest that the fixed-wing pilot, the Piper pilot, was handed off to the Newark Tower per procedure, and the pilot had never called into the Newark Tower. And the Newark Tower controller, seeing a potential threat, tried to reach the pilot after taking the handoff, and the pilot did not respond, indicating that the pilot was not yet on the Newark frequency. So what this means to me is we can have all of the rules in the world, and we can have every honest and genuine attempt to be prepared to fly in accordance with those rules. But if we're talking to a passenger, if we're turning around, if we're maneuvering in that airspace and we're not watching out the window, that's where the problems occur, whether it's here on the Hudson River or over the scenic falls or flying anywhere. We have a responsibility to look out the window. And I think most airplanes are maneuverable enough that we can see, you know, moments before turning in any direction, whether or not there's a conflict out there.
All right, well, I'm going to go one more place with you that I think is going to touch on a few nerves, but I'm not sure exactly where I come down on this, and that is the idea that theoretically, at this point, you can fly into that airspace without an engine-driven electrical system in a vintage aircraft with no radio, without strobes, without a landing light. And if you do that, you're legal. Are we ready to get to the point where we keep aircraft that don't have certain minimum equipment out of even VFR airspace?
Oh, I'm a great advocate of that. I think it should, and here, I'm going to make more waves than you just made. I think it borders on careless and reckless to operate an aircraft in a congested airspace, and that could be to a fly-in breakfast in a little Class G airport without a radio going. I know this is the land of the free and the home of the brave, and, you know, we're free and able to do what we want. But to be operating in this airspace today, in any airspace today, with the communication equipment capability, even if it's a handheld radio in a J3 Cub with no electrical system, this is something that that we need to have. And it'll be a long time before that rule is changed. But you're absolutely right, Paul. You can fly up the Hudson River in the Class G airspace, that's the floor below the Class Bravo airspace, and you could go up there in a balloon, a hot air balloon, if you had some way of controlling it, and again, without any radio or lights, perfectly legal as long as you're in the Class B airspace. Class G airspace.
I think what I keep noticing, Bob, when these accidents happen, is that, you know, 99% of the people in a given airspace at a given time are doing the right thing and being diligent. And it only takes one person who's heads down in the panel or who's talking to a passenger or any of the other number of things we read about in NTSB reports to mess things up. And it just seems to me that this will make things a little more complex, actually probably very, very little more complexity for the people who are already doing the right thing. But there are going to be a whole lot of people who don't need no stinking rules who are going to kind of roll their own anyway.
Well, that's right. And even when the rules exist, I mean, we have people out here that are not turning on their transponders because there's still this latent thought that it's a communist plot to track who we are and what we're doing. And this is absurd. We have the technology, and as you say, these collisions continue to exist and occur. We have the technology in large part to minimize them just by turning our... I had a case just the other day coming into my own little airport in Lancaster. I was making a landing, and just as I was touching down, a Cessna 210 came overhead and then departed above me and came around. And when he landed, I said to him, I said, that was an interesting approach. Well, what happened? He says, well, I never saw you, buddy. And I'm in a G1000 cockpit, which is showing traffic awareness. It's giving me traffic awareness. I'm listening on the radio with a student, and I said to him on the ground nicely, I said, were you on the radio? Were you talking? He said, well, I didn't hear anybody talking. Well, clearly he was not on the right frequency or his radio wasn't on. Then I said, did you have a transponder turned on? He said, well, I don't rightly know. And now the transponder, if his transponder's on, we can see him on the traffic collision system on the airplane. Well, if his transponder's not turned on and he's not talking on the radio, then he's a ghost. I mean, we have no way of seeing other than to, you know, obviously look out the window, and which ultimately is the best defense. But we have the technology, Paul, and people in very rare cases, but enough to cause us concern, just simply do not use that technology.
Well, Bob, we'll encourage them to use it. And I can't argue with the need to have, you know, the minimal equipment level if you're going to fly in VFR in the New York airspace. And I guess we'll just see how it goes and watch how things go after the NPRM is done. I appreciate your insight on this, Bob. I know you fly there from time to time, and we will talk to you next week.
Thanks, Paul.
You can find the latest edition of Bob's newsletter at overtheairwaves.com. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. Find us on the web at aero-news.net. I'm Paul Plack. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.